Welcome to the Principled Podcast, brought to you by LRN. The Principled Podcast brings together the collective wisdom on ethics, business and compliance, transformative stories of leadership, and inspiring workplace culture. Listen in to discover valuable strategies from our community of business leaders and workplace changemakers.
Hello and welcome to another episode of LRN's Principled Podcast. My name is Ben DiPietro. I'm the editor of LRN's ENC Pulse newsletter. And with me today is Forrest Deegan, Chief Ethics and Compliance Officer at Abercrombie & Fitch. Hello, Forrest. Thank you for taking time today.
Hi, Ben. Good to speak with you.
Let's start at the beginning. Tell our listeners about how you became attracted to ethics and compliance, the path you took to get to your present position as CECO ANF.
Sure. Yeah. I think my story kind of reflects the industry as a whole, really. I got started in private practice, 15 odd years ago, and bounced around doing some general litigation, some international arbitration, and ended up doing a lot of work for some of my old law firm's institutional clients, right? And so you start with things like investigations, right, and review and enforcement. And then when you gain their trust, you get to do things that are a little more proactive, a little more interesting. That led to going from not just investigation to remediation and then further to program enhancement. And so the problem solving for the client is really what led to the compliance career at my law firm. And honestly, the more of that work I did, not just putting Humpty Dumpty back together again, but sitting him on a lower wall, the more of that I did, the more I liked it, and the more, frankly, expensive I got as outside counsel. And so, as my career progressed, I realized I think I could have more meaningful and lasting impact in-house if I had access to the whole sandbox. And so that's when I began looking for in-house opportunities. And so 7 years ago, my wife's also an attorney, we made the move from Washington, D.C. to Columbus, Ohio. She went to work for the Ohio AG's office, and I came to Abercrombie & Fitch, and I came in as our first director of corporate compliance with a focus on anti-corruption. And consistent with that kind of evolving career, additional responsibilities, expectations have been put on the role. And I became, about 4 years ago, Abercrombie's first chief ethics and compliance officer. And one of the fun things about the job is, like I said, I'm the first, and a lot of my peers at other retailers, they're the first. And so to be part of this, not just institutional, but industry-wide growth has been an exciting journey.
What was behind the decision to add ethics into that title, and how has that changed what you do?
Yeah, so I think the decision came down to, there was not a need to separate out in a position the have to from the want to. I think what was recognized is in retail, in-house generally, you've got a more lean organization, people are expected to wear more hats. We didn't see any value in making that distinction. And something that I've realized in my practice is whether you're talking about a regulatory compliance issue or a corporate value compliance issue, it's all standards. It's all standards enforcement, right? And so the same tools you're going to leverage around having a policy, having a program to monitor, report, and enforce, that's going to apply whether you're doing something that you have to do by law or something that you want to do because it's your corporate value or your philanthropical approach. And so I think understanding you're going to have the same tools available to you has made it easier to kind of demystify the concept of compliance and combine the two things together.
As someone with a legal background, you're well aware of the big debate that's been taking place over the last decade in the ENC community about whether compliance should be separated from legal, and if so, how. And obviously, some companies have made that decoupling. And wondering now that we're about 10 years into that, what you see from that, how programs better when they're disassociated from legal's oversight, and why do you feel that way?
I mean, we talk about this a lot in the retail space. Another one of the things I love about, corporate compliance is how collaborative the community is. So we get together and we talk about issues like reporting and job responsibility. And it has been a big question whether ethics and compliance should be together, whether they report to legal or just straight to the audit committee, whatever. I've seen, honestly, in the past couple of years, a shift away from that separation back towards what's actually going to move the needle? You know, what's operationally going to work? I've seen a shift back towards reporting to GCs. I've seen that in some of the surveys done by, frankly, done by LRN, done by some of the other research groups that are out there polling for reporting lines. As long as the work gets done, right, I don't see a material difference between the two. Speaking from my own experience, I think it's helpful to have it combined. I think that you are able to, you know, have more synergy and a greater ability to collaborate when you're with a larger group to begin with. And so I think it reflects that reality of being in-house, of being lean, to have that, again, some of those control functions organized together.
What do you feel about how this has all played out? I mean, obviously, there's been a lot of talk about this. Did you feel a lot of the concerns were around general counsels maybe exercising too much control over compliance and not having it be as independent? Has that not really played out in the real world?
Well, I think independence, right, and you see this in some of the prior DOJ guidance documents, not the last two most recent ones. They haven't really pointed to a absolutely separate line as they were kind of hinting at historically. And I think that reflects the reality of if you have a line to the board or to the audit committee, right? And even if you're not on every meeting, if you have access to them and the ability to reach out independent of the GC or whoever you're reporting to, that can suffice. I think that's reflected in the reality, certainly of my situation here. I feel I have the necessary independence. I report to the general counsel with that dotted line with regular reporting on the agenda of the audit committee, as well as, like I said, that always open channel, which gets exercised both ways. You know, there'll be follow-up questions that come from the audit committee to me and other issues I'll bring to them.
Aside from this debate about legal's role, what would you say is the biggest change in the last 5 to 10 years as to how ethics and compliance is practiced at corporations?
It has been a remarkable evolution, right? I think I started out by saying I'm the first here. You know, my peers at other retailers, they're the first there. And 10 years ago, right, when I was starting to seriously consider moving in-house, we were still in that mindset with corporate compliance of it being hotline, right? Maybe we'd added anti-bribery. FCPA is something that was de facto corporate compliance. That's really shifted, and I think people have come to understand it again as more broader, that concept of standards enforcement, that concept of telling your good story across your, not just your legal and regulatory obligations, but also those other standards you put out there. When I came here, started connecting with other companies based in Columbus, you've got L Brands here, you've got Express, a number of other companies where we get together on a fairly regular basis, the chief compliance officers do, to kind of talk about reporting lines and best practices. And, you know, those first couple of meetings, we didn't have a term for it yet. I think somebody used the term big compliance to talk about what was next and where we were going. The big has dropped off of it because we understand now that that expectation is broader.
And that's a look back. Looking forward then, what do you see driving this profession forward through the 2020s?
I've been thinking about that question a lot. And I think there's kind of two answers, right? There's one for the have to work, and there's one for the want to work. On the have to side, your legal regulatory obligations, I think about your assurance functions, your control functions. As we have matured and enhanced our compliance program, same thing has been true with our enterprise risk management, our third party risk management. And that's really leveraging other internal stakeholders, internal control functions, right, to better protect and promote the business. And as we have kind of started to flex those muscles in a more coordinated fashion, there's an increasing expectation that we don't just coordinate, but that we're also consistent in our approach. Because if audit committee is going to hear from three different control functions about, you know, risk assessments or, you know, top five risks to the company, we want to be able to explain if there are differences, why, right? Everything needs to have a consistent theme to it. So on the have to side, I think of increased engagement with the other control functions, increased collaboration across, frankly, the three lines of defense that are available. And I see that kind of going into the future, right? We have as a retailer, we have obviously our corporate compliance function, our hotlines. We also have a robust store security, store health and safety, and third-party monitoring program. better leveraging the data that's collected from all these different touch points, right? To have a holistic view of what our risk is and how we're addressing it. That's kind of the have-to side. On the want-to side, I think about on the control function side, what you're doing with your, you know, your risk players is you're preaching to the choir, but you're giving them prettier hymnals, right? When you talk about your want-tos, your corporate values and your mission statement and your principles of conduct, that's really getting into, you know, going out into the congregation. So instead of just the choir, you're now going out into the congregation. And there you've got to interact and play well with your HR partners, right? Whoever leads your associate engagement, both in terms of communication, surveying, and then same thing, monitoring for changes in behavior and risk. So on the want-to side, I think playing better with and having a more coordinated effort with those that help enforce the standards of conduct and the principles and the value statement. So I see that evolution continuing along both lines.
You also teach a compliance course at the University of Chicago. What does the class cover? How long have you been doing that? What are you trying to accomplish? And what do you get out of it personally?
Sure. So I'm wrapping up my second quarter teaching the class. And I have to say, it felt better to be asked back than it was to be asked the first time. Right? It was quite a relief that things had gone well and to get that vote of confidence from the University of Chicago Law School. The class I teach is called Corporate Compliance and Business Integration. And it is a seminar. This term, we ran it as a simulation class. And it's an opportunity for students to see how some of these legal and regulatory regimes that they've been hearing about, and for a couple that they maybe have not yet studied, brief introduction to, how those things play out within a program, right? Within a corporate compliance program. And, you know, at University of Chicago, a lot of the law students there, they've got a lot of opportunity to go in-house or go into government, go to big law. Wherever you're going, you know, you're in a client service capacity, the lessons of understanding your client's risk, right? Understanding what they're walking in the door with when they come to ask you a question, understanding that and embedding your solutions within how they already work, that's going to translate across industry. And so what I try to do with the class is hit a couple of common regulatory regimes. So we do go through anti-corruption. We do go through some InfoSec and data breach rules. We go through AML and OFAC, and we go through like a employment related harassment discrimination issues at a high level. And then we have the students form fake companies, right? Where I've put together 10 Ks that they've got to do a risk assessment on, and then define how they want to spend a scarce amount of resources on compliance tools, depending upon how they've done their risk assessment, right? And so it's an opportunity to learn high level about a number of different risk areas, but also the process of dealing with scarce resources, prioritizing and weaving a narrative through not just how you spend those resources, but why. The other thing I do with it is take advantage of the opportunity to bring other speakers in, right? You know, the reason I teach the class is because there was nothing like it when I was in law school. It's still an evolving profession, and I think it's an opportunity to kind of inform this, you know, next generation of law students about what I as an in-house lawyer need, right? What I want people to come out of school with. There's a bit of selfishness there, but I bring in folks from the tech industry, from the entertainment industry, from the banking industry to talk about their compliance journey and how each of these risk areas or each of the risk tools that are available to you, how that plays out in their job.
How do you weave in conversations about ethics and culture into all this? Obviously, compliance doesn't really work without those things, and they're a key component to this, and I'm guessing that's a part of the curriculum too.
It absolutely is. So the way that I talk about the levers available to a compliance officer, obviously you've got your policy procedure, your staff, training, communication, and your monitoring, reporting, and enforcement. So how you decide to use those is going to be done on a risk basis, right? You're only going to have so many resources. You've got to understand your business, understand what your risks are, and where it makes sense organizationally to put people or to put training or to put monitoring, right? When you take all of that together, right, that adds up to your culture of compliance. And something I say for my last lecture is this idea of it all comes back to the individual, right? And whether you are a compliance officer or whether you're just a frontline employee, you need to understand your role as an agent of the company, right? Maybe you're not supposed to be the AML expert, right? But you are supposed to understand in your job what looks right, what feels right, and what to do if something seems out of place, right? So if we're able to activate those frontline employees, if everybody understands their role as an agent of the company, that's where you get attraction with your culture, and that's where you get a stronger culture of compliance.
Well, let you out of here with this last question then. How can universities and even high schools do a better job to incorporate lessons about ethics and compliance into their classes and get students ready for these issues that they're going to have to deal with in their workforce?
You know, I think that the more chances that students at whatever level, starting in high school, going up through college, through post-grad work, the more chances those students have the opportunity to see the skills in practice, right? So that they get practitioners from all walks of life coming in and talking about not just their journey, but what their lives look like today and what works for them, what they need, what they don't. The more concrete some of the concepts they're already learning about in school become to them, and they will better realize that bigger picture and how to stay on the right path, right? The way, thinking back to high school and college, right? I got to do one internship in high school, and in college, I took a survey business foundations class where each different offering was a practitioner. So we had a marketing class. There was a, you know, chief marketing officer who came in and he taught the seminar, advertising, legal environment of business, on and on. Having access to the practitioners and seeing how it plugs into the day-to-day, so taking it out of that academic setting, even while you're in the academic setting, I think that's the best approach for ensuring and instilling that the values, you know, doing the right thing, of speaking up, of being transparent and driving accountability. I think the best way to go is with the real life example.
And let's hope they get those lessons and bring them forward as they come into the world. I want to thank you so much for taking time today, Forrest. We really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode. The Principled Podcast is brought to you by LRN. At LRN, our mission is to inspire principled performance in global organizations by helping them foster winning, ethical cultures rooted in sustainable values. Please visit us at LRN.com to learn more. And if you enjoyed this episode, subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen. And don't forget to leave us a review.